You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Now we have AUT's Alan Blackman joining us in the studio for Dear Science. How are you today, Alan?
I'm very good.
Thank you, great. He's here with me and Adam. First up today, we're chatting about how the argument around water fluoridation has come back into the media over the past week. Can you talk us through what's been happening?
Yeah, well, the wonderful Michelle Dickinson, a.k.a. Nano Girl, took a fluoride campaigner to task over this campaigner's letter to the MP, and which basically blamed the MP's two miscarriages on fluoride, which is just really rather reprehensible.
Totally, yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. And so this created a bit of a storm, certainly on Michelle's website anyway, and she wrote a very reasoned rebuttal to all of this, and this was obviously picked up by News Hub and publicised, etc., etc. And so it's basically got fluoride back into the media and the whole question of fluoride. And this has been going on for, years and years and years and years and years. Mm. And it does kind of rear its head every now and then. Certainly with regional councils, the devolution of whether or not sort of local water supplies should be fluoridated, and that decision has in certain cases been devolved to city councils and the like. And I think sort of down Tauranga or somewhere.
I think it was Hamilton a while ago.
Yeah, that's right. No, you're right. It was Hamilton, yeah. And the big question over whether they should fluoridate or not fluoridate and everything. And the major argument against this seems to be the quote-unquote fact, that fluoride is apparently bad for you. And this is promulgated through various so-called scientists in the so-called scientific literature. And the way that this sort of works probably bears some explanation, I guess, because often we find that people who are sort of actively opposed to anything scientific will quote the fact that their facts, their alternative facts, have been published in the scientific literature. And the way that the scientific literature works is that you basically submit, you write your paper, you write up your findings or whatever, you then submit it to a journal, the journal then sends it out to reviewers to basically referee your paper, find out whether you've done the experiments right, whether your conclusions are justified. They then send it back to the editor of the journal saying either yes, publish this, or yes, publish it, but make them make some changes first because we've found some problems with it, or no, don't publish it at all. Those are basically your three things. And once that's been sorted, once the editor then sends the decision letter back to the author, and then says, "Yep, you're good to go, or you got to make some changes, or we're not going to publish this." And if it's the first two, then you make your changes, send it back, and then it gets published. And where it gets published is all important, because as in anything, there are good scientific journals, there are average scientific journals, and there are mediocre scientific journals. And the good scientific journals will be ones that your readers have probably heard of, like sort of Science, Nature, New England Journal of Medicine, those sorts of things that you hear about in the media fairly often when there is a big thing happening. And the good journals are reserved for the truly groundbreaking pieces of science. So, and that should tell you something, really, that if you're piece of science that you've published is not in the best journal out there, then it's not a groundbreaking piece of work. It is merely bog standard, average, or even mediocre, or even wrong. Because sadly, there are journals out there who will publish anything. The reason they will do that is because you have to pay to publish a paper in those particular journals. So we call these predatory journals. And they, sadly, are proliferating at a great rate of knots at the moment. Every day you get an email, or I certainly do, every day I get an email from a new journal saying, come and submit your paper to us, we promise it'll be reviewed and published within a week, which if anybody knows anything about scientific publishing...
That's not a realistic timeline.
All you've got to do is pay us your $400 to this bank account in generally India, and you will have it published. And so the fluoride research that often gets quoted in the literature comes from the low-tier journals.
Mm.
Absolutely it does. And again, if there were a proven link between fluoride and all of these health problems that fluoride anti-proponents, shall we say, claim, then it would surely be published in the New England Journal of Medicine or The Lancet or Science or Nature or those really, really good journals. Now, that's not to say that some rubbish doesn't get published in those journals. It does. Sometimes it slips through, but it's very, very rare. You can basically hang your hat on the results that are in those very, very good journals. Whereas for these lower level ones, the results are either routine or dubious at best.
Mm.
And so whenever somebody points to the fact that this, you know, that something's been published, that it's in the scientific literature, you've got to take that with a grain of salt. You've got to go and then look up the journal in which it was published and say, right, how good is that journal? And as Michelle Dickinson said on her website, the main way in which the quality of a journal is judged is by a thing called the impact factor of the journal. And that is based on essentially the number of other scientists who read the papers that are published in that journal and quote them in their own work. And so the higher the number of quotes or references or whatever you want to call them, or citations, I guess is the scientific term. So the higher number of citations that a particular journal gets in a year divided by the number of papers that it publishes in the year constitutes a thing called the impact factor. The higher the impact factor, the better the journal, basically, because the more people are reading it and the more people are recognizing that the work published in there is worthy of being cited.
Mm.
So
wasn't also in this case the research that was quoted by the anti-fluoride activist that was taken from a journal in India that looked at a particular context in India with pregnant Indian women?
Yes, yep.
And it was totally inapplicable to the New Zealand context
as
well.
Yes, indeed it was, yeah. And I believe that the situation there was that they had extraordinarily high levels of fluoride in the groundwater anyway, so they had about 4 parts per million, whereas the natural occurring level in New Zealand is about 0.5 ppm, 0.5 ppm. And that's the naturally occurring limit. And what we do is we bump it up to about 0.7 to 1 ppm, which has been shown to give the most effective...
have the best effects
on your oral health. Mm. So
and also this is monitored very closely as well.
And you know, one of the other arguments that the anti-fluoride people use is that they use industrial waste as their source of fluoride, which is again a load of nonsense. Fluoride is fluoride is fluoride. It doesn't matter where it comes from. So and the anti-fluoride people do have their own journal, which is just called Fluoride. And where you will find, funnily enough, lots of articles sort of railing against the bad health effects of fluoride. So if you've got a journal that's run by, you know, the anti-fluoride people, chances are
the research is going to be tarnished in that sort of particular way.
Yeah.
So staying on the theme of debunking science myths, let's move on to our next topic today. So something you've said on the show several times now is that there is no such thing as alternative medicine. There is only medicine and not medicine.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could flesh this out a little bit more for us.
Hopefully it just sort of stands as it is. I think it would should be fairly self-explanatory, really. But the whole, I guess the words alternative medicine haven't been around for really very long, maybe sort of, you know, the past 20 or 30 years possibly. And now it's trying to be rebranded as, say, something like complementary medicine or words to that effect. But it's still the same sort of thing. There's medicine that works, and then that's it.
Mm.
Okay? So if it works, it's a medicine. If it doesn't, then it's not. And so we have things like, dare I say it, homeopathy. You'll get phone calls. you know, which is classed perhaps in alternative medicine, but it's not, you know, it doesn't work. Where are the clinical studies that say that it's anything better than the placebo effect, which is the way that any sort of positive results from that can be explained?
Mm.
So, you know, and I guess a lot of people think of alternative medicine as being sort of natural. That's often a word that's bandied around as well, that if something's natural, it's got to be good for you. And so things like, for example, the first plant-derived drug that was marketed was, in fact, morphine, which was dated from about 1820s or something, apparently. And that's derived from the opium, which is derived from the poppy.
Mm.
So you can extract that. And, you know, that people would call that a natural medicine, which it is. It absolutely is. It's derived from plants. And there are a whole lot of medicines that we use today that are derived from plants. Aspirin is certainly one of them. So that it was known since, at least a couple of thousand years ago, that boiling up willow bark, and if you drank the extract of that, it would help with fever and stuff like that. And essentially what you have in willow bark is nearly aspirin. It's just differs in one slight respect, but basically that's it. So people found way back when that when they tried this willow bark extract, it was horribly bitter and they couldn't get people to take it. And so they just chemically modified it, put a little group on the molecule, and everything was good. And that's how aspirin came about. So a lot of natural compounds have been used as the basis of drugs, and that's a good thing. But there's also natural compounds out there that'll absolutely kill you. Okay, so one of the most toxic things on planet Earth is a thing called paleotoxin, and this was found in one single rock pool in Hawaii, and I think a teaspoon of that would do for the entire population of Auckland. It is that toxic.
Wow.
Yeah. So it's extraordinarily poisonous, but it's natural.
Mm.
So natural doesn't necessarily mean, you know,
does not make it inherently healthy or good for you.
No. So, you know, don't go touting things as being natural as being good for you because they're natural, because they're not.
Mm.
You know, there's way more to it than that.
Totally.
And that's kind of where the alternative medicine practitioners, again, in my view, come. They're trying to say, right, well, you know, you've got these horrible, you know, man-made, quote-unquote, drugs, you know, and they're bad for you, but we've got all these things in nature, and so therefore they must be good for you. No, they mustn't.
Mm.
Some certainly are. The World Health Organization has got a list of 252 drugs that are considered basic and essential, and of those 252, 11% of them are derived from plants. So we certainly owe a debt to the natural world for some of our drugs. Absolutely we do. For others, we owe a debt to scientists for coming up with these.
Absolutely.
So.
Yeah, and I just think it's very important that reiterate what you mean by this is that fundamentally, like, this is how science works. It's not being narrow-minded. It's that what exists as scientific knowledge is that which is robust research behind it, and that new things and new ways of thinking are added to this body of knowledge all the time.
Yes, absolutely.
But having that fundamental research is what, you know, that's critical criteria there.
That's the basis of science. Yeah, everything is testable in science, and if it doesn't pass the test, if it doesn't work, then you discard it and you go on. So if something is proven to be false, if something is proven to be harmful, then, you know, by all means get rid of it. That's the way that science advances. The fact that, yes, science can be wrong, or, you know, people's work can be wrong, and it can be shown as such. It can be shown to be wrong. And things that we think are right today might be shown, you know, 100, 200 years down the track to be wrong. And sadly, that's what gives the alternative medicine people hope.
Right, yeah.
Because they'll be saying, well, you know, we don't think it's true today, but, you know, give us a couple of hundred years and, you know, we'll show you.
But it's like, well, you can do that with research, and then
it
becomes medicine, or it becomes scientific knowledge, and that's fundamentally how this thing operates. Yeah,
okay. No, agreed.
And so our last topic today, talk to us about a new controversial TV show that has been criticised for glorifying suicide. Talk to us about this.
Well, this would be the first time I've ever talked about mental health, I would say, on on the radio. And so the series 13 Reasons Why, so this came out on Netflix a couple of weeks ago, and my partner thought, oh, this looks really good, it's all over Facebook, let's watch it. And so once we started, we couldn't stop and binge watched the whole thing in 2 days. So to cut a long story short, it is, as you say, the story of a high school student's suicide. Not to give too much away, what she does is she leaves 13 cassette tapes behind, each of which is basically dedicated to one person, and which outlines the things that that person did, basically, that drove her to the edge and made her take her own life. Now, I was listening to national radio this morning. I'm allowed to say that on this station, aren't I?
Of course.
I don't know, it might be blasphemy.
Where the Mental Health Foundation representative was on, saying that it was glorifying suicide, and he didn't think that it should have been shown. And I was quite astonished by that. I think the last thing that this program does is glorify suicide. I thought it was an absolutely gripping, dramatic, very, very, very realistic depiction of just how horrible people can be to each other. And the depth that people can sink to, I guess, as a result of those terrible acts. And some of it was very, very, very difficult to watch. Mm. Extraordinarily difficult to watch. The actual suicide itself was, it was tear-inducing. It really was not a glorification of it at all. So, and again, on national radio this morning, they had a high school student interviewed as well who... basically saying that this sort of stuff is not discussed in schools, and it should be, and the fact that this has been shown has now led to some sort of debate, and surely that can only be a good thing.
Mm.
If people are feeling like this, then maybe, I don't know, the fact that here's a depiction of that other people feel the same way, you know, maybe that makes things easier, I don't know, but... it's surely not a sort of thing that shouldn't be discussed.
So you're saying that the proposal that this should be censored and shouldn't have been launched in the first place isn't the right sort of way to receive this program?
No, I don't think so at all. I think it's it's a compelling TV program. I think it's absolutely brilliantly done.
Mm.
And I would urge everybody out there maybe to watch it and make up your own minds.
Mm. Full disclosure, I haven't seen the series myself, so I can't speak about my own opinions of it, but I have read several critiques about the show and how it tackles suicide.
Yeah.
One of them said that it tackled it in a sensationalist and reductive way because it depicts the main character, Hannah, her suicide as a way to expose the actions of her peers and makes them feel guilty rather than actually trying to explore the nuances of mental illness. I think that there's a line from the article that said that it attempts to take on suicide without even mentioning the word depression. I just wanted to know your thoughts about that.
Possibly, yes. I can't remember the word depression being mentioned. Then again, how many suicidal people mention that word anyway? Possibly, you know.
Aren't able to seek that particular help and recognize it for what it is before.
Yeah. But again, it is one of those things where people will have to make up their own minds. But you know, all of this publicity that it has garnered, it's going to ensure that people watch
talk about it
and talk about it, and I think that's the most important thing. Having said that, I'm not sure that it's a show that's really aimed at teenagers, possibly. It seemed to me to be sort of aimed at a more mature audience. Maybe that's just my feeling. I'm a more mature audience, I guess, and I found it riveting. So maybe young people do as well. But you know, it needs to be watched. It really, really does.
Absolutely.
So.
Great. Well, thank you for joining us again this week, Alan, for, I think it's a responsibility to say for anybody listening, and you might have any of those thoughts yourself, Lifeline New Zealand, the number to call is 0800 543 354. Yeah, I think it's a really important thing to be aware of, that it's important to recognise these things and to talk about them.
And talk to people. Absolutely. Yeah. Talk to people.
Great.
That was Dear Science.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.